Dennis Kimathi, thanks for joining us. And yes, in this question, I'll shoot it to you, Darius. And yes, assuming the Court of Appeal agrees with the petitioners of BBI, what are the chances of us having a referendum within the current constitutional framework?
First of all, just to respond to the question that asked Tungala. Yes, there is a document that was online. Somebody was able to basically catalog the number of organizations from around the world who, in a certain way, was in support of these amendments, and not sure to what levels they are offering whatever support they are offering, but definitely. Once the issue was flagged, then I think a number of them publicly stated their withdrawal, whether it was in monetary or political support or a diplomatic sort of endorsement, in a sense advisory to the whole BBI basically infrastructure. Coming back to the question you had asked, public repository of this information. That a lot of countries go to war within 24 months before or 24 months after, actually 12 months before or 12 months after a referendum. And that is because a lot of referendums are rarely informed by a society's self-reflection and the desire to sort of move itself forward or change certain provisions. Most often, referendums are an acknowledgement of, basically a split within the elites. It's usually the collapse of elite consensus that drives most referendums in a lot of countries globally. And you can pick any countries with any major sort of civil dysfunction, especially that plays out even into a war or political, sort of violence. And you can always trace there was a referendum somewhere within the 24 months of that, or within 12 months of that document. So having it now, and then having an elections right up ahead in which the president and the vice president have fallen out, coupled with a referendum in itself, which is quite unpopular, and an economy that is not fully functional at this point in time, that is a recipe for trouble. All the legal, frames around it notwithstanding, of course, the eventuality or the inevitability or the possibility of a referendum will be decided by, of course, the courts. But it's a very, very, risky political game to play within a nation, that you go to a referendum within a period where you also have an election that is so hotly contested. A referendum after that may be a possibility. Of course, it will still be challenged within the current provisions that have been given. As I mentioned, civic education, public participation, constitutional assembly, and the referendum itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Darius. Shiko, Dennis Kimathi asks you again, within this context of BBI, there have been also conversations that have come regarding academic qualifications for members of parliament and members of county assemblies. Dennis Kimathi asks, what do you make of this?
Wow. I think this is quite an interesting conversation. And the only question I keep asking people when they ask me that is, if we expect a secretary in a bank or in a shop or wherever this person, a receptionist for that matter, to have a certain degree, why don't we expect someone who's going to make decisions that affect your life, hold billions that you pay in form of taxes, and also budget for the well-being of your life and the services you get, go in there without a degree? Why is it that we have to be very double standards in a way that if I'm electing you into power, I'm doing you a favor, you don't need degrees, go buy yourself clothes. Yet I'm paying you, I'm facilitating all your well-being. But for you to actually get a job, you need a degree, 10 years experience and all these things. Maybe on top of a degree, we need someone with also 5 years work experience in certain places to get these positions. Because I feel like we've gotten so many people in power who have no idea of what is their role there, have no idea on even the specific seats they serve, what are their roles and what are the JDs to be precise. So we end up screwing ourselves over and over again, because we rely on people who are not even open to learning. And I want to take us back to when the campaigns, of course, the campaigns are always here. But isn't it always worrying when an MCA comes and tells you, within the first 100 days of me being in that seat, I'll build schools, I'll build a hospital, I'll make roads. Isn't that a red flag? Isn't that one thing that we should be like, we cannot elect this person? That is not his mandate. He cannot. Where will he get the money from? So the fact that we never have these conversations, the fact that we have been lied to again and again, maybe having it mandatory for people to go to school, get educated, and also get some experience before vying for these seats will be like prudent for us as a country.
Mm. Interesting. Another question from the panel, Purity Mukami.
I can just chip in briefly on the conversation.
Yes, please, Darius.
On the qualifications conversation, there is a certain way in which the public space is currently disadvantaged when we go with a degree. No doubt it's a very important document for that. But I'm thinking if you're a country of 28.5 million adults, you've constrained your education system such that it's only awarded it to 900,000. There is a 2018 report, I think June, which basically says, in Kenya right now, children of the top 10 percentile are 48 times more likely to make it to university. Middle class kids are 3 times more likely to make it to university. I understand the necessity of, you know, a university degree in this dispensation and how it helps us to, you know, basically legislate and all that. But then there's this conversation to have on, you know, by having a degree, it's important in terms of how it helps, you know, with the cognitive and intellectual conversations and policy conversations for, you know, the legislatures and the respective political offices, but on how exclusionary also it will become for a lot of people, because it will basically say of your 28.4 million adults, 27 point something basically don't qualify for public conversations. How about if we took this provision a different way and said, there are a certain number of modules within Kenya School of Government, which as long as you have the bare minimum, which now is a Form 4 certificate, you have to take X number of modules. And that essentially ensures that, you know, you were able to qualify as part of, you know, basically our IEBC qualifications. That ensures you're not being highly exclusionary in a system that the education system has been very exclusionary, but also it ensures that the people so don't get in there simply because, you know, we don't lock people out. So can we have a third way such that, you know, you're not locking everyone out, and you're also not allowing anybody who, you know, has barely, you know, any bare minimum understanding of how our government works getting into this position. Yeah.
Yes. Well, thanks, Darius, for that. Shiko, another question for you from Purity Mukami. And she asks, thanks, Purity, for joining this webinar. She asks, how do you distribute the power away from Nairobi more, other than adding through money that goes to the counties? Well, what are some of the things that we can do to distribute power and resources away from Nairobi? Basically, what she's talking about is how do we decentralize resources away from Nairobi and the elites who want things centralized?
I think that's quite an important question. And I think Ngala sort of expounded on this earlier on. But for me, it's about understanding that devolution was not meant for just finances. It did not just mean the 15% that goes back to the counties. This meant that even industrialization, when you talk about the parastatal, when you talk about these things. But funny enough, this government of ours has been able to sort of be corny enough to devolve things that they feel like, okay, this can do, but also to retain things that give them more money. Like the youth as a block, youth is never devolved. You talk about the youth enterprise is still an issue of national government. But the question I keep asking is, if we can devolve health, why not devolve youthhood? Why not take it back to the counties for them to run their own issues with their own young people? But one thing I keep saying is that we have the 30% tenders to youth that is a scam. Maybe we need to take control of that. We have the Youth Enterprise Fund that is also another scam. We used to also take control of that. If we are able to bring these resources back to the youth, and if we are able to build skills and create a system that works for our young people, then that makes sort of will enable us to make the first step. My only fear is that where I come from, especially, we are 3 hours from Nairobi. And what happens is I graduate today and I move out tomorrow to move to Nairobi to look for opportunities. Maybe we need to also start pushing our county government to sort of start looking for investors to come and invest in our counties. Maybe that will also open up the industrial space and give us more opportunities. But as long as we still see kazi kwa vijana kama kuchimba mitaro, kuosha choo, na kufagia barabara, then we will never move.
Mm. Thanks.
Yeah, I just like to jump in there.
Sorry, Ngala, that interrupted you. As you're jumping there, there's also a question for you. You can answer both because of time. Cool. So there's Martin Ngoni. He asks you specifically and he says, going forward, what happens to the rural succession politics? And where does that leave the current political players within the context of BBI, and it mentions to you particularly for them and within the context of marginalized communities, and this moment do you see, because it says you're from the coast, where does that leave 22 politics within this current political context?
Yes, so I just wanted to add onto the previous question regarding how else to decentralize beyond money, right? I think that was the question, and I feel like this is my favorite topic actually. It was actually the subject of my master's thesis some 7 years ago, and I was looking at the coasts, right? And the clamor for devolution, if you look at Bomas, if you look at the Lancaster conversations, it was not only about money. In fact, it was not about redistribution of money. It was about a distribution of power, right? So that people, if, for example, this is an example that was given that came out of Bomas. If people, for example, in a place like Tana River or Garissa feel that they need to have control over the police, who police them in their region, they should be able to do that, right? This is the kind of power people are talking about when it comes to decentralizing power away from Nairobi. It's also power about the policy process. So I hear people always saying that, you know, health services have been devolved, but I think the devolution there that has happened is you have devolved management, you've not devolved power, you've not devolved power over the policy process around health. The power still resides at Afya House, if you ask me, right? The power still resides at KEMSA, right? Like the when people talk about power, it's power to decide, to make policy around an issue, right? And to have power over that, not to follow what the national government is dictating should happen across the territory. That's why we still have Irrigation House in Upper Hill, right? And this is the kind of thing that Kenyans wanted to be, you know, to be corrected through devolution. And it really hasn't happened. The other question about where we are moving towards 2022, I feel this is more of like a political analysis question. And I'm not a political prophet. I don't claim to be. But I feel that for places like the coast and northeastern Kenya, which for me sadly enough seems as if are still operating, like the politicians who are from these regions are still operating as vibaraka. You know, I'm looking for the English word for this. As sort of followers of politicians who come mainly from upcountry Kenya, right? And this is also something that I've always kind of talked about in my work, that the politicians at the coast right now are talking about which side to pick between what is now the Tanga Tanga movement and the BBI kind of Uhuru Kenyatta Raila handshake movement, right? You do not find still a sort of regional specific conversation about where the coast should go politically and economically. We still don't have that. We have fragments of that, Jumuiya ya Kaunti za Pwani, but still the political process is the same. People looking to join political parties that have been conceived and formed by upcountry politicians, usually coming from a few ethnic groups, as Chico was mentioning earlier. And this is the same for Northeastern Kenya. So like this, you know, within the context of BBI, despite devolution, people from regions that were previously marginalized or seemed to have been marginalized, are still kind of clients of politicians from, you know, Nyanza, from central Kenya, and following political formations, political movements from these regions, rather than really defining national politics. That we are still not seeing that. So maybe what, I mean, in very real terms, maybe you're expecting that a running mate will be chosen from some of these regions, or maybe some promises for cabinet positions from these regions. It is still the same game for me. I don't think like anything transformative has happened so far.
Thanks, Ngala. Darius, there's a question here from Murithi Mwanekia. Thanks for joining us at this webinar. And he's wondering how do we, because his question is around how do we expand this kind of engagement within our communities. But he's focusing his question regarding the how do we restructure our public sphere, you know, from this very colonial public sphere, so that it begins to reflect the voices and the aspirations and hopes and dreams of the people. What are some of the things we can do that moving forward? Asks Murithi Mwaniki.
Yeah, I think the public sphere is always a very complex and a layered space. You know, we all exist, you know, we're in the city, we're also out there in upcountry, and we sort of occupy different small ecosystems within the wider public sphere. I think the most important thing is to realize that the centralization problem has to be, you know, first of all, consistently tackled, that Nairobi should not be controlling 21% of basically our national economy, such that within this dispensation we are in, where because of COVID, which probably will be here for our entire lifetime, such that a simple spike means if you shut down Nairobi or you limit or minimize the business, social, and economic activities around Nairobi, you're already impacting almost 21% of the economy straight up. You know, that's on a very unhealthy structure, so to speak. I think it's important that, and especially elites, to realize that for the proper functioning of this society, for the proper functioning of this country, for the proper functioning of its various levels and systems, it's important that no one single space or square kilometer has such a massive and outsized influence on your national reality, such that when you have to do the inevitable kind of lockdowns and curfews and all these kinds of COVID measures, that you're making such a huge hit on the overall economy. I think this conversation came up. First of all, Nairobi itself controlling 21% is a huge problem. Number two, when Eastleigh was locked down, there was a whole area of Mathare that was basically, almost starving because a lot of the laborers in Eastleigh come from there. And so when you begin to look at those kind of social settlement systems, your anthropological realities, your distribution of infrastructure, your distribution of income, wealth, and opportunity in light of something like COVID, then that should be our biggest motivator to say, move this, you know, reorient your public system, reorient your public square in such a way that, you know, you're no longer captive to the inevitabilities, because we'll do lockdowns and shutdowns and all these things for the rest of our lives, you know. So you almost have to budget for something like a 9-month economy in terms of time, but also you have to budget for a kind of an economy that is so redistributed, a public sphere that is so democratized that, you know, you're only able to lock down certain small systems, and if the other systems can keep functioning in such a way that the overall impact on the economy is minimized. So there's all the motivation to do it. Of course, there's all, both economically, there's all the motivation to do it out of the 2007 political violence and the inevitable, fears that came with the centralized system that we have then. There's all the motivation to do it because technology allows you to do it. You know, people are producing blogs and you know, videos and TikToks from far outside of the city. It's important that especially for the clusters that exist within the city to realize that the Kenyan life and the Kenyan society is not emblematic of Nairobi. You know, just to take one example, just briefly, the increase in gas prices. I mean, there's a whole breakdown, I think Kwame Owino did, which was basically saying gas is a very urban phenomenon in the country. But our conceptualization of it was, this is going to impact the entire nation. Of course, there's a whole conversation about how to keep, you know, provide cheaper energy so people don't destroy forests and all that. But in a sense, you begin to see this urban-rural divide that is a very, not really urban-rural, it's a very Nairobi versus the rest of the country kind of a divide that we need to tackle right up from.
Right. Thanks for that. The last question actually to Shiko from Purity Mukami. And I mean, and she's asking that there are very many barriers to the youth engaging in political processes, you know, education, economic dynamics. She asks, what are some of the things we can do? Because the conversation has always been, particularly within mainstream voices, that we need to involve the youth, but a lot of it is rhetoric. But what are those barriers that she's asking that we need to do as the youth, you know, as the youth use that word very carefully, enable to us to break those barriers and enter to those spaces where we can able to engage in the political processes to shift the country?
So one, I think we need to allow ourselves to start reading the constitution. It's very unfortunate that you can be in a meeting with over 200 young people and none of them has ever seen the constitution. It's not their fault. This document is rare. And if you're not in the circles where you are interacting with civil society, it's rare for you to find just a copy of the constitution. So yes, we know it's online, but how many of us have the ability to read it online? Also, acknowledging that our documents use the elitist kind of English, where not a majority of us will end up understanding really much. And that's why we see, even when we have court processes and people trying to explain the constitution, sometimes we feel like they're also contradicting themselves in this, at the same time. So I think it's up to me and you, Mukami, to just start breaking down this information to the youth in our circles. I am a believer that the each one teach one spirit works best, where if I learn something, it's my responsibility to teach the people around me. And it's also their responsibility to disseminate it to the circles beyond them. And I think we have the best platforms right now. We have TikTok, we have Instagram, the Reels and everything. And we're making very beautiful videos. So maybe it's time we start also making videos, educating people about these spaces. Because for us to meaningfully engage and meaningfully participate, we have to have the information and we have to have the knowledge. And unfortunately, the people we trusted in terms of coming and giving us the civic education, even of our own constitution, which is the government, failed terribly on that. So maybe it's time we just take up the mantle, educate each other, and start also using the spaces that we have. Imagine having social media, which I know, like Facebook now, I think has free Facebook or something. So why don't we use these spaces where they are cheaply available. We know a majority of our youth can access them. Why don't we use these spaces to just educate each other and see how much we can mobilize each other towards achieving a meaningfully participation in political processes?
So I just like to give one of you, each of you just 1 minute to just give your parting shot as regarding to the question of inclusivity. So, I mean, by and large, all of you are saying the BBI process judgment project doesn't give the youth inclusivity to political processes, to power, to resources, to economic avenues for them to fulfill their hopes, dreams, and aspirations. So then, as a parting shot, let's give each of you 1 minute. I'll start with Darius. Then, what do we need to do moving forward?
I still insist young people need to take stock of where we are at in terms of our participation in electoral processes, in political party processes, and in basically political processes, party politics and electoral process, but also to be able to say then, where do you go from here? Have you begun the process of organizing, of where to get the resources, of who's where and doing what, such that you're able to build alliances across board? That would be very critical in terms of are stepping into this space and being able to now get our seat at the table and get our voice there.
And thanks, Darius. Shiko?
So as we take stock and build alliances, I always like to say that as young people, we must acknowledge that even if you file nil returns, you still pay VAT, that is 16%. And now you'll be paying 20% for the TALA loans, I'm sure the loans that you always take. Just for us to understand that if you're sleeping hungry today, there's someone who should be held accountable. And those are the people you elected into those political seats. If you cannot afford rent, if you're not able to even get a job, if you're not even able to access education systems and health systems in Kenya, there is someone who can be held accountable. And the moment you start holding those people accountable is the moment you start taking charge of our political processes. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chico. Finally, Ngala.
Yeah, I think for me, just reiterating what has already been said, I never bought the idea that the BBI actually was looking out for the youth. And again, for me, this kind of economic language, when it comes to thinking about and dealing with the youth, is old. I mean, the youth are interested in power, and I mean power with a capital P. And the youth need to, their voice needs to inform serious political processes in the country. And I think the question should be, maybe the next discussion, how should you create that? How should you create a critical mass of young people who can then begin to really disrupt the political system in a very serious way? For me, that would be the parting shot.